positive kind of reflection. Air can also be doing some refraction. In other words, when you see the sunlight shining on a pool of water, and you look at those shadows moving around in a funny way at the bottom of the pool, that's the water acting as a lens and doing refraction action. So all of these things take place. I'm not going to go into them right now, but if you Google those words, reflection, refraction, and diffraction, and if you look at the fact that filter you hang on the front of your camera, let me drop. The majority of what that filter does when you put that on the front of your lens of your camera is a bandpass filter. It is allowing certain frequencies to pass through and attenuating the others. The blue filter allows the blue to come through and stops all the others. The sky is not necessarily a simple, thin, little filter you would hang on your lens. That sky is 6 miles deep, and it's a whole lot of billions and billions of little bitty air molecules that are all doing their individual scattering thing. And so there's a hell of a lot more going on there. And if you want to go one step further, when you use a polarizing filter on the front end of your camera, and you take a picture at right angle to the sun, if assuming the sun is coming to you from the south, and you look dead east or dead west, and you take that polarizing filter and turn it just right, you can make the blue sky turn very dark. The white clouds will turn much brighter by comparison. You can get a very dramatic figure, a photograph, because of the polarization characteristics of that scattering of those air molecules. I'm just throwing those words at you. We're not going to go there today. But if you study the polarization characteristics of sky scattering, that's another whole art and science, if you know what I mean. Look what you got us into, Kathleen. KC2.
Can I add one more comment to help you out there?
Go right ahead, Glenn. We're trying to keep it simple. We're having fun here. You got it, Glenn.
Well, the sky being blue is such a fun topic. But the Rayleigh scattering, I hope I'm saying the man's name correctly, but Rayleigh, R-A-Y-L-E-I-G-H, I believe, scattering is a type of filtering. But it's not the same as the type of filtering that Eric was talking about, where you put the lens, in other words, where the sky actually, because of scattering, allows everything to go through. But the blue, it is passing through, but it's scattering side to side. So it's not as if it's being stopped, like with a traditional filter of type of blocking. It's the scattering itself that allows the sky to illuminate blue, because the path of the light is really what's changed. So it's no longer a direct path. So instead of saying that it's really blocked isn't really correct. It's really that it's more of a scattered or instead of the red passing straight through and all the other colors of broadband light going straight through the atmosphere, it's that it's really being redirected, like you said, to the side. And that's why you see all of the polarization effects when you're putting them towards the sky. Trying to keep it simple, Dick, but it's hard. KC2QIQ.
That's almost as simple as illuminating a piece of glass from the sky. I'm going to give you guys my best example of scattering. You're in a dark room, the sun is shining outside, the shade is pulled, and there's a little bit of a slit alongside of the shade. Somebody's cut a small slot in the shade so that some of the sunlight is coming through into your dark room. You sit in that room, and you get that spire, you get that streak of light coming through the shade into the dark room, and all of a sudden you'll realize, wow, look at all those dust particles floating around in my room. Those dust particles are scattering devices. The sun is hitting them. All around, everything is dark because you've arranged the room that way. You just got this little shaft of light coming through the window, and all of those dust particles that are in everybody's room, all of a sudden you'll see them because the light is striking the dust particles and bouncing off of it, just like radar echo. And your light and your eye sees them, and you can be high, low, left, right, anywhere in the room, and you'll see all those lit up dust particles. That is light scattering, and the dust particles look primarily white because they're big enough to encompass the wavelength of the light. So there you're seeing a macroscopic view of what takes place with the microscopic or atomic level scattering of air molecules. By looking at the dust particles in your room, you're looking at the exact same phenomenon, but just much, much bigger scattering particles. That's why the dust particles look white, And because there's zillions and zillions of particles of air that are so darn small, you can no longer resolve them anymore. You just look at the overall light that reflects from them. And if the sky is thick enough in miles as it is, all that scattering adds up and you see blue. If you're a serious astronomer, you're going to go to a very dark area. Let me drop it. You're going to carefully choose the day when the sun is not when it's not raining, when you've got clear sky, when you've got non-turbulent atmosphere, and no moon. The astronomers really hate moon, my goodness, because it lights up the whole non-sky, and the sky scatters light, and therefore they can't see dim objects anymore. Look what you got us into, Kathleen. KC2, Victor Charlie Tango, thank goodness. Back to you for any comments, and please come back next week, K2LIW and the TechNet. We like hearing from the people who live in Fleetwood, New York. You got it, Kathleen.
K2EJ with the final blitz.
Yeah, let me let Kathleen say a few words first. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate all of that information. The dust thing was a very good visualization for me. And I'm in the process now of trying to find some of that stuff on the internet just so that I can at least bookmark it so that I can refer back to it. Thank you very much. Like I said earlier, I appreciate all the knowledge that you guys have, and I love listening just because even if only one little bit sinks in, something always sinks in. So thanks a lot, and I really enjoy the segment.
Kathleen, on a quick break. Are you a teacher? If not, you should be. KC2, Victor Charlie Tango, K2LIW.
No, I'm not a teacher. I used to work in school, but not anymore. I do like kids, and, you know, I would certainly like to try and have something like this to get my nieces and nephews interested. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, properly exposed, your nieces and nephews can easily turn into scientists, electronic engineers, mechanical engineers, chemical engineers, and so on. It takes curiosity. You got to create the right environment, and if that curiosity is properly satisfied temporarily, because no matter what you know, there's a whole lot more you want to know. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, Dick, I want to drop two more things on you. One, in your example of a slit in the window and the light coming down, you see the beam of light coming down and hitting the floor. Now, what do you see, assuming that you could have an absolutely dust-free environment and a perfectly clean mixture of air? Will you see the beam hit the floor, or will you only see the light reflected off the floor? And the other thing is, as I mentioned before, if you have a piece of glass, you light it from the side, because your glass is a medium that has its own velocity factor, and you could think of it as two reflective edges of the light within, bouncing within it, having its properties based on the molecules of the glass, and then extrapolate that, and astronomers want to use achromats, and the reason for that is to reduce those kinds of effects. K2RIW, K2J.
The thing that I enjoy an awful lot is when I'm talking to the guys who like building microwave antennas. See, my first love is microwaves, the frequencies above 1,000 megs. And from the microwaver's point of view, I'm down here on the DC bands of 144 megacycles talking to the FMers. And they say some derogatory remarks about me from time to time. Anyhow, to the microwave people who are trying to get the most amount of gain out of, say, a parabolic dish antenna, where you're working with a relatively small number of wavelengths. Rarely is the dish antenna more than about 10 wavelengths in diameter, whereas a good parabolic mirror on a good telescope can easily be 300,000 wavelengths in diameter. And although the phenomena is almost the same, the performance you get differs by a whole lot. Because you've got a limited number of wavelengths on the parabolic dish, on the microwave antenna, you rarely get more than about 60% aperture efficiency. Because the optical astronomer, with his parabolic reflector, the exact same kind of an antenna, but he calls it a telescope, when he drops. You can easily build what an optical person will call a diffraction-limited optical telescope, and you can easily get 96, 97% aperture efficiency when you've got a real good reflecting coating on that mirror. And why in the world can the optical people get such high efficiency and the radio people cannot? And the explanation for what's going on there, oh boy, you can have arguments until the cows come home. But there's some very hard physics that you can't exceed, if you know what I mean. An ordinary feed horn in front of that dish, it's not the blockage of the feed horn, it's the aperture distribution. In other words, if the heat feed horn was perfect, and when you're transmitting, it would send the exact same amount of energy across every portion of that parabolic reflector. At the center and the edge would all get the exact same amount of energy, and then the energy would drop off abruptly at the edge so you don't have any spillover. If you could design a feed horn that can do that, you'll get 100% aperture efficiency out of your parabolic microwave dish antenna. There's a catch. Let me drop. In order to get that much control of the signal coming out of the feed horn that's going to the microwave dish, that feed horn must be a minimum of 30 or 40 wavelengths in diameter. It must be built as a cluster feed, a very elaborate, what would you call now, shaped phased array antenna with just the right amplitude and phase angle to each one of those many elements inside of that cluster feed. In order to get the right aperture distribution on that microwave dish, you would have to have a feed horn that is itself 30 or 40 wavelengths in diameter. If your hold on parabolic reflector is only 20 wavelengths in diameter, then your feed horn is giving you complete blockage. You're better off just aiming the feed horn at the target and say the hell with the reflector. So for a bunch of physical limitations, you can't do that, if you know what I mean. Whereas the optical astronomy has no trouble doing that. Your cassegrain antenna, that sub-reflector in there, is 100 wavelengths in diameter. It gives you all kinds of control of the way the signal is fed against the main reflector. So the physics of what's going on at the molecular level, at the wavelength level, and so on, when you go down to that level and study it enough, it answers a hell of a lot of questions. And some of these questions that John gets in his mailbag, some of them really are mind-blowers. These guys are sometimes not yet in ham radio, but my goodness, we got some darn good people coming down the pike as I see it, John. KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2RIW the TechNet. You got it, John.
Dick, let me stop you. I got one question for you.
Go ahead, Eric.
Based on what you just said, why do we choose a parabola as opposed to a paraboloid or a spheroid? Now, we could have a perfect spheroid for a reflecting mirror and a perfect inverse spheroid for a collecting mirror, an angle mirror in a Newtonian telescope. Why do we choose the paraboloid, the parabola, as opposed to a paraboloid or a spheroid?
For a whole bunch of mechanical reasons, the world's biggest parabolic dish antenna on planet Earth is located in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, the Cornell University, what used to be called Ionospheric Observatory, 1,000-foot diameter, round-ish dish built between three mountains and inside of a valley in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, 1,000-foot diameter dish. And let me think now, the biggest fully steerable one is the so-called Great Big Telescope, Green Bank, West Virginia. That's 330 feet. Yes, it's still the biggest, 1,000 feet. They built that as a spherical reflector, not a parabolic reflector. They built it spherical for mechanical reasons. The way they hang those wires between those mountains to make that round, 1,000-foot diameter reflector antenna, it was a hell of a lot easier for them to make it spherical than parabolic. They gained one great big advantage of making it spherical. Let me drop. By making it spherical, they can move the feed horn east and west and steer the beam coming out of that spherical reflector. So they get a very nice side effect benefit by it being a spherical reflector. That's the good news. Mechanically, it's easy to do, and it can steer the beam. The bad news is it gives you a beautiful focus that is not a point focus. It focuses along a line. So in the center of the dish, at the so-called focal point, all of that energy from space comes together as a vertical line perpendicular to the dish. Therefore, the so-called feed horn is a line feed. It is a great big long, let me call it mast, with a whole bunch of little radiators along the mast to collect that signal when they're listening, or to radiate that signal when they're transmitting. So the good news about a spherical reflector is it gives you a nice focus and you can steer the beam, but it focuses to a line, not to a point, and therefore you need a very different design of that feed horn. And a decade and a half or two decades downrange after they started using that dish, somebody came along with a better design of that line feed that gives them a better amplitude and phase distribution that gives them a little bit more efficiency out of that dish. And that dish was used for some very interesting measurements of pulsars. And why can't I think of his name? Cole it is right now. K1, the guy who does all of the WSJT. K1JT, Joe Taylor. Joe Taylor used that dish. Let me drop it. K1JT, the inventor of the WSJT digital technique for listening to very weak signals. Joe Taylor, K1JT of Princeton University, using that dish antenna, measuring the Doppler shift he was getting from a pulsar, which was really a binary. It turns out of all the stars that are out there, more of them are binaries than unaries. Our particular sun is one of those slightly rare unaries. The majority of stars out there are binaries, two stars going around each other. What Joe Taylor did was to find a pulsar, which he found out it was a binary because he listened very carefully to the pulses coming out of it and recognized that for half of the orbit of those two stars around each other, he was seeing positive Doppler shift of the pulses, and the other half he was seeing negative Doppler shift. Therefore, he discovered a binary pulsar system that gave him the Nobel Prize. And so when you go to any of these microwave conferences where Joe Taylor is one of the talkers and he shows you that beautiful gold Nobel Prize that he was awarded, he's the guy, a ham radio operator, so to speak, although there's a hell of a lot more than a ham radio operator, who made that measurement on a spherical reflector. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ, thank you for that. I like that. Actually, I guess in another way of saying it, the spherical reflector, the spheroid, as I call it, really is a spherical offset feed disc. It's the way you could look at it. That's a very interesting concept. I mean, when I was building my own telescope mirrors, you really start off making a spheroid. You're essentially making the surface of a ball. And when you get to the end of doing the lap and the pitch, you then start to bring it out into a paraboloid, and then eventually a parabola. And then depending upon the wavelength and the focal length of the mirror that you're trying to create, that's how you determine by using a focal test. You actually use a template at first that you draw out and try and do it by eyeball at first until you finally use a knife edge and look at the interference pattern to try and create the final piece of glass. But that's a very interesting story. Thank you, Dick. K2RIW, K2J.
A couple of decades ago, any serious optical astronomer, usually unless he had $1 zillion in the bank, had to grind his own parabolic reflecting mirror. In the process of grinding that mirror, there's a whole lot of art and science to walking around that barrel with these two pieces of glass with the right kind of abrasive material between the two, and you're sliding one over the other in a very characteristic manner in order to generate that concave shape of the reflecting mirror that you're trying to generate. And the number one guy on Long Island that I know of is John Vogt. John Vogt, who is one of the key people of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, of which I was a member for a number of years, ground his own 33-inch diameter mirror. And he did it twice because the first one cracked. That 31-inch diameter mirror on his homebrew telescope, my goodness, is that a light bucket? Is that a collector? That telescope, the mirror essentially sits on the ground, which is called a, can't think of the man's name right now, for the kind of mounting device.
Dobsonian.
Say it again.
Dobsonian.
That's the one. This religious man from I forget which order he was in, invented something called the Dobsonian, Mr. Dobson, invented the Dobsonian mounting technique, where the mirror essentially sits on the ground on a pivot, and the rest of the telescope sits above it. It's the lowest mount you're ever going to get. And John Vogt's 33-inch diameter mirror, homebrew telescope, the eyepiece on the front of this Newtonian telescope is about 12 feet off the ground. You have to stand on a stepladder to look through the eyepiece of his telescope. And when you're looking at a telescope 33 inches in diameter, do you see a view? Wow. You wouldn't believe it. We all make jokes about the fact you need a parachute to get back down.
Repeater, time out.
All the ASLI members, Astronomical Society of Long Island, we make jokes about the fact that when you get down from the eyepiece of John Vogt's telescope, you have to use a parachute. And of course, it's a great big exaggeration. But when he appears at Stellafane, the real big optical get-together of the homebrew telescope makers in Stellafane, Vermont, he's one of the big guys everybody wants to visit and look at his particular piece of hardware. Very well done. So where was I going with that? So you build the telescope big enough. And right now, Hawaii has just given permission for the telescope to be built that's going to be 98 feet in diameter. It's the 30-meter telescope. Is about to start construction. That is a biggie. And so we used to think that the Hubble Space Telescope was the best you could do. Well, some of the ground-based telescopes are getting so big with adaptive optics to take out an awful lot of the atmospheric effects. And so they're all doing some very good work. Kepler, that beautiful telescope that recently had a failure that Paul may be telling us more about, discovered thousands of potential planets going around other stars. There's a lot of life out there. That's what we're seeing, a lot stronger and stronger evidence. We used to think planets going around a star, like the Earth going around the Sun, we used to think that was one in a million. We're slowly discovering that almost every single star has planets. What used to be one in a million is every one of them. In other words, our estimation of how much potential life is out there just went up a million to one. And you ain't heard the end of that story yet. And so some of these guys that John hears about from his letters start asking us these kind of questions. So what kind of questions did you get this week, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Nice for everybody to stop by. Interesting questions tonight. And it's good you were talking about dishes, because that's my first question. Let me drop, and I'll come back with this question. Okay. This gentleman has two 36-inch off-center fed dishes, probably from cable TV, something like that. And he wants to know what kind of a project can he build and what can he buy to add to these. He'd like to surf the solar system or the star field and pick up some noises. What should he do and how should he go about it? Or is he wasting his time? Back to you, Dick.
Oh, he's not wasting his time at all. Oh, is there things he can do? Wow. You take the 18-inch dish that's used for satellite television reception, modern-day satellite television reception, and that is a beautiful offset-fed dish, approximately a 0.6 focal length to diameter ratio. I own a few of them, and the fairly serious guys don't have to spend a whole lot of money. The dish itself, you go to the right place to buy it, you can buy it for numbers like $10 and $20. The feed horn and the low noise amplifier that's used for satellite reception. Not a whole lot of money there either. State-of-the-art 10 gigahertz low noise amplifier with feed horn that's built for that particular dish. Numbers like $20 sometimes you can buy those, and they've got a small fraction of 1 decibel of noise figure. Let me drop. And they come out with a 2 gig IF. And there's ways you can modify that. But so there's roughly a 10 gigahertz signal, gets reflected by that dish, comes up to that feed horn, gets sucked up by that feed horn, goes into the electronics right at the feed horn, which is an extremely high technology, low noise amplifier with about 50 decibels of gain to it. And it converts that 10 gig signal, I'm rounding off the numbers, down to a roughly a 2 gig signal. 900 to 1400, I think is the frequency region. So it's around a 1.5 gig signal. And so by having a receiver that can tune to that frequency, you now have an extremely good radio telescope. That dish has something in the vicinity of a 4-degree beam width. So if you could see the signal coming out of it, if you were transmitting, it would look like almost like a flashlight beam. And when you take that dish and you aim it at the sun, it turns out that there were many decades of prediction of people knowing how the sun works, knowing that eventually we're going to measure solar radio noise. And it wasn't until Mr. Southworth, right in the middle of World War II, first made that measurement successfully. And there was a lot of decades of gnashing of teeth and trying to make hardware and measurements and whatever before World War II. It was the World War II radar developments that allowed us to come up with sensitive enough receivers. There happened to be a crystal diode front-end mixer receiver, but we just barely got sensitive enough receivers in roughly 1942 for the first time to measure sun noise. Nowadays, with less than $100 worth of hardware, when it comes to the dish, the feed horn, and the low noise amplifier, you've got 90% of the hardware to measure sun noise measurements. I have done that. The guys on 10 gig ham radio, when they want to measure the sensitivity of the receiver, you would think they would build a real low noise, real small signal generator, like Hal's crystal calibrator, so to speak, and some of them do it that way. They'll start off with an 8 megacycle crystal, multiply it like crazy by shoving it into a diode mixer of some kind, and look at the 192 harmonic of 8 megacycles, 8 gigs, here we go, 8 megahertz, I think it's 192 harmonic, comes out at 10.368 gigahertz, the ham band, so to speak. And they'll make a weak signal generator, hold it in front of the dish, and confirm that everything's working. Well, there's a whole lot of benefit in not even doing that. Just aim the dish at the sun, and you get three benefits from doing that. The sun at 10 gigs makes a very predictable amount of noise day in and day out, regardless of the sunspot cycle. Let me drive. That system can easily see 10 decibels of noise rise, 10 to 1 power ratio increase of the noise coming out of the receiver when you aim that dish at the sun versus cold sky. So that's a beautiful radio telescope-like measurement. And make the dish a little bit bigger, and now you can start sweeping it across the sun, looking at the difference in the noise power coming out of the sunspots versus the portions of the sun that don't have sunspots. So that's the beginning of sun measurements. From my point of view, if you're building a radio telescope and you're really measuring how much noise comes out of various celestial objects, Cassiopeia A, Cygnus X, and other galaxy-like things, to do it at 10 gigs where you've got a reasonable size antenna and high enough directivity because you're on a high enough frequency, you get a lot more bang for the dollar, in my opinion. There's a lot of guys who start off in radio astronomy at HF and VHF frequencies. Well, unless you're willing to build antennas that are hundreds of feet in diameter, you're not going to get the kind of directivity you can get at the higher frequencies. And we amateur radio operators are discovering that every decade, we go up almost 10 to 1 in frequency and make new developments of hardware and DX contacts and whatever. Let me drop. For instance, about 3 weeks ago, the distance record on the 80 gigahertz ham band just came back to the United States. Two guys in California on two mountains, roughly 240 miles apart, with homebrew equipment, made a single sideband QSO, Morse code and then single sideband, on 80 gigahertz. That's a frequency. That's a serious frequency. We used to be able to only dream about that. You keep going up higher in frequency, and that's how the so-called 200 meters and down book was written way back in the 20s, where somebody thought that the higher frequencies above, let me pick a number, 3 megahertz, were useless, given over to ham radio operators, and they started making DX contacts with it, discovering the ionosphere and so on. The higher frequencies are always given to the ham radio operators thinking they are useless. And we've been through that scenario over and over again. And the hams start building hardware, start making contacts, and find out each higher frequency has got its own characteristics and its own benefits. So I'm going to jump off to one side for a second to go back to what Eric was saying. Let me drop.
By the way, commercial gear, 56.
very expensive, and the hams have found ways of home brewing. The ham radio operators I know of, can't think of Brian's last name right now. Okay, having trouble thinking of his call letters. He's made lots of QSOs on 241 gigahertz and something like 350 gigahertz with homebrew equipment, two-way QSOs, Morse code. He hasn't done it on sideband to my knowledge, so the hams are up there in frequencies. But in the days 20, 30 years ago, you wanted a serious optical telescope. You had to grind your own mirror because you couldn't afford to buy what was available. Nowadays, with computer-controlled grinding machines that can do such an accurate job so fast, very few people want to grind their own mirror. With the exception of John Vogt, he wanted something 33 inches in diameter. He couldn't buy that unless he was a millionaire. But he built it for a few thousand dollars, and it was an extremely well-done project. But what I'm getting at is, say, for instance, you and I, Eric, wanted to build an 8-inch diameter mirror optical telescope today. Let me drop. We could spend a year of our life grinding that mirror, or we could spend 4 days of our salary buying the mirror. Obviously, buying the mirror, you're way ahead of the game. If your main objective is to build a good telescope and the mirror is the main object, buy it today. You don't grind your own mirror today. However, what I'm starting to predict is that because the automatic grinding machines, computer controlled, are getting so good, it's only a matter of time before the optical telescopes become offset-fed parabola, offset-fed Gregorian, offset-fed Cassegrainian. In other words, the best optical telescopes we can buy are the refractors, the one that's just got a lens out in front and the eyepiece way out in the back. That's the good news, but the bad news is you can't build a piece of glass big enough, accurate enough, with the right kind of optical corrections. So when it comes to real big apertures, it has to be a telescope. The telescope is done with, it has to be a reflecting telescope, like a parabolic mirror. But the parabolic mirror always has an object in the middle of the mirror. It's the 45-degree reflector up front for a Newtonian, or it's the hyperbolic subreflector in the Cassegrainian. You've got this hole in the center of the optical path, and that gives you certain kinds of disadvantages when you're doing something like looking at a planet. I think it's only a matter of time with the automatic machinery right now where you and I are going to very soon be able to buy an offset-fed 8-inch, 10-inch diameter mirror, where now the hyperbolic subreflector or the Newtonian 45-degree mirror is going to be off to one side, not creating a blockage. Yes, it's a more complicated mirror to grind, but with the automatic machinery, I think it's just a matter of time before you and I can buy that, Eric. What do you think about that? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
KD2CX.
Repeater, timeout.
Craig recognized, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, Dick, well, I took a trip up to Corning about 6 months ago, and they're building new machinery for some of the bigger telescopes. Actually, the mirrors are no longer a solid piece of glass. It's done in segments on its own individual mounts, which are servo-controlled to actually compensate the temperature and the shape of the glass, depending upon the temperature and where it is. And, you know, at 15,000 feet, like on top of Mauna Kea, they need that kind of stuff because even the Earth moves a little bit. So it's interesting. Yeah, no, I see that as a reality coming. Interestingly enough, I had a couple of guys over help me clean out some stuff. We found one of my 12-inch half-made quartz blanks with the plate glass tool. Maybe one of these days I'll get around to finishing it. It's at the point now where it needs the pitch in a lap and probably about 3 or 4 weeks of really careful arm movement, and I'll have another big hunk of glass that can either get aluminumized or silvered. KQIWK2J.
As I was sort of getting to earlier, Eric, when a person wants his own optical telescope, he's got to decide, he's at a crossroads. He can either build it or buy it. If you want to enjoy the process of the very piece of arty scientific procedure required to grind a spherical, then parabolic mirror, go ahead and grind the mirror and enjoy the process. If it's not the mirror grinding that you enjoy, but you want to enjoy looking through the telescope, then you're way ahead of the game today to take a couple of days worth of your salary and buy the mirror whatever diameter you need, and then buy the optical tube and start putting it all together. Or if you're really a little bit richer, go out and spend $3,000 and buy a Ritchie Cretchen type, a very well optically corrected, fully operational telescope with motor drive and computer control and star finding and whatever. There's all kinds of equipment out there. The guys in their backyard these days have got optical telescopes that can give you a photograph of the sky. Not too far from what Mount Palomar's 200-inch diameter telescope out there in California would be very proud to display 10 years ago. The guys in the backyard on Long Island can do that kind of stuff now. They're finding comets and making discoveries of variations of certain stars and so on. Craig, I know you wanted to add some more words to all this or question. KD2CXK, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KD2CXK. As you know, Dick, I am an amateur astronomer and I'm in quite a few clubs. Back to what you were asking, I'm sort of mentioning before, the reflector without the central obstruction, as it's referred to, is referred to as an off-axis Newtonian or off-axis reflector. Orion telescopes recently used to sell a 4.5-inch, I think it was an F8, they referred to it as an off-axis imaging Newtonian. And that was one of the first mass-produced ones on the market, and it sold for well under $1,000. And that can be found now on the used market. That's about it. KD26K, K2LIW.
Glad to know that, and I didn't know that until now, Craig. That particular machine that you just described, once again, tell me how many inches in diameter of the main offset-fed mirror, that offset-fed Newtonian, and roughly how many years ago was that available? And I know that being offset-fed, unless you do some pretty fancy correcting, you're going to get a little bit of coma distortion. And to your knowledge, have they done some correcting of the coma distortion? KD2CXK, K2LIW. Go ahead, Craig.
That was a 4.5-inch mirror, if I remember that. A pretty small Newtonian. May have been a little larger, but I know it wasn't anything above a 6. It was about 3 or 4 years ago. They do appear on, and I don't know if I can use the term, but there is a website available for used higher quality astronomical gear. Where I do see it pop its head up from time to time. It sells used for about $400 or $500. And it is an F8. And which means on a Newtonian, F8 is considerably on the longer side. So that's probably how they get rid of some of the coma, by just, lengthening the focal length. KD2CXK.
Well done. And the whole reason why those 18-inch diameter 10-gig dishes that are used for direct television reception, satellite reception, the reason those feed horns are off to one side is to make sure the feed horn is not giving you a blockage and that kind of a, let me think now, would I call it Newtonian? No, it's an offset-fed parabola, and it doesn't give you the blockage that you would have if the feed horns was directly in front. The side lobes are looking at cold sky. It's an extremely high-performance antenna of only 18 inches in diameter. So to start off with that, to do radio astronomy and or 10 gig ham radio is an extremely good beginning, and it's a fairly inexpensive, rather high technology piece of hardware, and properly used, it can have a lot of fun. My first recommendation, getting back to the original question, I know we've drifted pretty far from it, John, my first recommendation is that person should go to the two websites immediately. Number one is WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org, Tom Williams' website. You go to the various pages of that website. It is an encyclopedia of ham radio, microwave ham radio. And whether you're doing it for, whether you're doing it for direct two-way communication or radio astronomy or whatever, there's a whole lot of second and third page websites you could go through from Tom Williams' microwave reflector site. Tom is one hell of a, what's the word for it now? proselytizer is not the right word. Johnny Appleseed, he's an extremely good guy at spreading the word as to how much fun microwave ham radio can be. There's one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. There's roughly one serious microwave ham radio operator per ham. So we're talking about four or so people per million in the general population. And those particular people all know each other on a first-name basis. And the Tom Williams website, the microwave reflector, and that website I mentioned to you, is going to give you a tremendous amount of information as to how to use pieces of hardware like that. When it comes to home brewing, feed horn, and things like that, the second website you want to go to is Whiskey One Gigahertz, Whiskey One Golf Hotel Zulu. That is Paul Wade's website. He's got a so-called online textbook, and you look at the various chapters of that online textbook that he has been assembling over the last 15 years. It'll show you how to make homebrew feed horns, homebrew converters, and whatever. So those two websites, W1GHZ, I think it's .org, and WA1MikeBravoAlpha.org. You go to those two websites, start reading, start finding out zillions of ways you can use that offset fed dish. It's going to give you a lot of ideas. If you want to really get serious about radio astronomy and not ham radio, then you want to go to the website of amateur radio astronomers. I can't think of their call letters.
Repeater, time out.
The Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. SARA. S-A-R-A. Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. Yes, SARA. There's a SARA website. You just simply Google the word SARA, S-A-R-A, and you'll become in contact with the guys who are very serious about radio astronomy, homebrew in their backyard. Those guys get together at the Green Bank, West Virginia site of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. They get together in June. I think their meeting has probably already taken place. In June, every single year, they have a great big get-together at that site. And that's another very enjoyable thing. So those three leads, and the person coming back and giving you more questions, John, and we answering those questions, are going to lead the guy down a very interesting path if that's where he wants to go. KC2WGB. Another scientist on the way, John. K2LAW in the TechNet.
By the way, Dick, the satellite LMDs run from 11.8 to 12.6 gigahertz.
Well done, Eric. And the guys will take those things from 11 to 12 gigs and do a very minor modification to them to use them on the 10 gig ham band, 10.368. And why do they use that particular frequency, 10.368 gigahertz? It happens to be a direct harmonic of 144 megs that everybody uses in IF, and they also use it as a multiplication to listen to their own signal. They listen to the umpty-ump harmonic. All of a sudden, I've forgotten what harmonic it is. It's the 1200th harmonic, something like that, of 144 megs is 10.368. KC2WGB. Look what you're involved in, John. KC2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, it gets a little better because these dishes, they're 36 inches in diameter, these offset, off-center fed, and he has two of them, and he's thinking of using them sort of as interferometers, but he doesn't know anything about spacing distances and things like that. That he'll have to work out if you could recommend something or a tactic for him to use, but that's good with those websites. He can get started on at least one of them, and then he can follow his romance wherever it leads him.
Okay, he's one of the guys that got a hold of the 36-inch jobs. It turns out that 99% of all of the X-band dishes in the United States, they call them KU-band, satellite radio at 12 gigs, are all 18 inches in diameter. There's a small number of them out there that are 36 inches in diameter, for they are intended for the people who want to watch the so-called European satellites. In other words, if I'm sitting on the east coast of the United States and I want to watch satellite television coming from Europe, and I'm looking at a satellite that is low to my eastern horizon, I'm outside of its normal footprint, therefore I may use a larger dish, a 36-inch diameter dish, I can get good enough reception on it. So an awful lot of those 36-inch dishes are intended for the people who are doing satellite television reception of European television. When my 10-foot diameter TVRO S-band dish was in operation, I used to be able to watch something like 400 channels from space, and I spent most of my time watching NASA Select. And so, as you guys have heard many times, I was watching NASA Select at the time that the Challenger disaster occurred, and I was recording at the time. And when I play that recording back one frame at a time, my goodness, do I see things that are, to me, interesting as to what the mode of failure really was. So he's one of those lucky guys, and he's got a pair of them. Oh, boy. He was in the right place at the right time, because they're slightly rare, the offset-fed 36-inch dishes. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I hope he keeps us informed, because that could be an exciting project. He might be able to do something useful with that. Okay, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next. Okay, this is a rather simple question from a guy who has a boat, and he has a 2-meter radio on the boat, and now he's on to buying his third 2-meter radio because of intrusion of salt water and, you know, the atmospheric conditions on boats are terrible. He wants to know if it would be all right, or maybe somebody on the net knows what he can do to, I call it tropicalize, like he can spray it with lacquer or something like that. What would you recommend? He knows he can't wrap it in plastic and make it a hermetic seal because the heat is going to destroy it. So what do you think he should do, Dick?
Wow, that's a tough one. I know that when I was working for the Spectrum Analyzer Division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, roughly 1972, and I know that some of the various agencies of the U.S. government were using spectrum analyzers as a broadband receiver to do surveillance, reconnaissance, and whatever work. And I do remember a couple of the failed spectrum analyzers had been used in the jungle of Vietnam, failed, and by some means they were shipped back to the United States for repair to us. And they were sitting on the deck of a ship, and salt water was washing over them. And when we got those spectrum analyzers, they were useless. Oh, man. Every one of the rotary switches and potentiometers, everything with salt water poured into it was useless. Salt water is an extremely corrosive material. Let me drop it. So just putting a good piece of electronics on a sailboat where you're experiencing a salt spray, high humidity salt air, is eventually destructive. How do you stop that destruction? Boy, I think if we give Hal $1 million, I don't know if he's got a good answer in that one, but we're going to try. K6, Delta Papa Zulu. What would you do in that case, Hal? Did somebody make a Marine-rated ham radio, K6DPZ, K2LIW?
KD2CXK with yet another comment.
Craig, do you have an answer to that one? How in the world do you protect a piece of electronics from salt spray? Because, my goodness, the stuff that's inside of salt water, what it can do to electronics is just out of sight. You've got a great K2RIW.
Well, Dick, not only am I also an amateur astronomer, but a sailor as well. I've had a 40-foot sailboat, and I had an HF rig on there. SGC, Sierra Golf Charlie, is a company that makes marine high seas radios that operate on hand bands. They're wonderful pieces of equipment. Their antenna tuner is completely sealed and can be externally mounted. And the way you prevent these things from rotting themselves to pieces is not really the salt spray. It's the galvanic action. That's what kills electronics, and that's what kills alternators and just about anything else. When you have a boat with a propeller shaft sitting in the salt water, and you have dissimilar metals coming into contact with each other, you have a battery. So the easiest way to do that is with a thing called sacrificial zincs, and you put them everywhere.
Okay, so for a person that has your kind of resources, Craig, where you've got the pretty deep pockets, I am guessing the SGC PC brand of marine radios that cover ham frequencies, I'm going to guess they're going to be kind of pricey. So I'm going to ask you, how pricey? And do you know of any other solution? Let's say, for instance, that a Kenwood blank, blank, blank is my favorite radio, and I want to use it on my sailboat, and I want it to survive. Is there no other solution? KD2CXK, K2RIW.
Well, if you want to use an off-the-shelf home or mobile-based amateur radio, a piece of amateur radio equipment in a saltwater environment, there's several things you can do. And the first thing is get yourself a big tube of silicone and just try and seal it up best you can. The next thing you can probably do is do what they do with computer systems they put on boats. Tape up everything that has a piece of metal you need to access and spray it with lacquer. That has worked for many years. The most, I guess, common thing is just try and keep it good and dry and sealed and expect a certain life expectancy out of it. ICOM makes a model M700, which is a marine-grade HF radio, puts out 100 watts into a standard antenna tuner. And a company called SEA, is a company that makes a dedicated, sealed, watertight and airtight HF rig. I don't remember the output on that, but it's a similar unit. I'll let it drop for a second. Most marine-grade HF radios, or radios that we refer to as high seas radios, are channelized. They have specific channels where you can access the marine high seas operators like Whiskey Oscar Mike or Whiskey Oscar Oscar, and other dedicated channels. Many of them, such as the ICOMs and the SGCs, have real VFOs. Now, some ICOM units are channelized VFOs, where you get to program in a channel to anything you want and then save it, meaning it doesn't have a general VFO like we're used to. But the SGC does. SGC has a model called a 2000, and it sells for, with the tuner, for under $1,800. KD2CXK.
Okay, that's a possible solution. Craig, you and I have seen these very fancy plastic boxes that you can put a camera inside of. And now I can take photographs underwater with this camera that's in this sealed plastic box. And the seawater is kept off of the camera, and the camera operates very nicely. Do you think it's possible that I could buy a kind of a plastic box intended for a camera and put a mobile rig inside of it? How I'm going to get to the controls is going to require quite a bit of craftiness, and how I get the heat out of there, I'm going to have to use something like heat pipes and whatever, or a through the plastic aluminum heat sink. But is there the possibility I could take my favorite rig that is not marine rated, but put it into the right kind of a purchasable enclosure that originally was intended for a camera? But if I'm crafty enough, do you think I could make that fly? KD2CXK, I bet you considered that one. KQRIW in your second hand, you got it, Craig.
Actually, it's almost a mute point. You would be beating a dead horse, or you would be prolonging the inevitable. Because at some point, unless you have a little of a battery pack in there that you charge off the boat in a nice dry environment, the copper wires coming out of that radio have to touch something that's not copper. And that's the killer. The galvanic action will go right up that wire and start looking for soft metals first, which are usually the lead tin solders on the board. You will open up that rig in 6 months, and it will be white as a little globe your dad used to bring home to you from his business trips to Paris.
If I do a real good job of quasi-hermetically sealing the wiring that goes into that box that powers the radio, and if I have the right kind of sacrificial metallic objects on the outside, can I protect it? Can I have sacrificial zinc all over the outside of that box and stop that galvanic action that you just described? Over to you, Craig, K2RIW.
I will say no. However, you can slow it down to the point of where it doesn't matter anymore. The sacrificial zinc, yes, they do go on the outside, but they don't go on the box. They go in the water. They must come in contact with the salt water, and they must be attached to something that's attached to everything else. When you have salt water touching dissimilar metals, the softer metal will corrode first, and that's why they're called sacrificial zincs. So in that scenario, if you have the copper wires coming out of that for positive and negative, and the antenna, and of course everything else that's attached to that microphone, what have you, if you have all those at some point that touch ground, eventually touches zinc, and that's in the water, as long as you balance that voltage, and let me drop.
EC2QIQ with a comment.
QIQ recognized. Then you can get away with it. You can prolong it, and in some cases you can prolong it for a real long time. QIQ, I think is, well, I guess it's Dick you can call that. KD2CXK.
You've given us some good information there, Craig, and I've got something to add to it after Glenn. Glenn, you live 1 mile or so from salt water on the Great South Bay. An awful lot of that Great South Bay came right up to your property and gave you a lot of grief. So if you've seen what salt water can do, KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, I'll give you one of my cheap solutions to a lot of this problem. And I used to do this for basically radios that I'd use on the boat for, you know, just listen to broadcast radio, televisions, anything that you see is on the water, electronic, including just switches and everything else. When you don't want to pay top freight for all the real expensive sealed stuff, there's one great trick. It's called WD-40. And you open up the case and you spray it until the cows come home. And you'd be amazed how WD-40 has very, very little effect on the electronics, but boy, it prevents everything from rotting away. You spray it in the antenna connections. You spray it on the connector connections. You spray it on your battery terminals. Anything in a saltwater boat, WD-40, and you douse it whenever you can, and just try to stay away from things with mechanical meters. If you can have LED-type readouts instead of meters, because there's really not much that WD-40 is going to do for meters. KC2QIQ.
If I was spending a day on the beach, and I want to make sure that the sunlight doesn't bake me with ultraviolet and do all kinds of nasty things to my body, I'm going to put it on SPF 30. And if I'm really doing some swimming, I'm pretty sure the SPF 30 must be replaced every X number of hours. Therefore, my question to you, Glenn, is the WD-40 does a good job when it's sprayed everywhere on the radio in places that it can tolerate. How often must I replace the WD-40 spray? If I'm using my radio on the sailboat day in and day out, do I have to respray it roughly once every week? Rough guess on my part. Your best information on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Honestly, with stuff that we use out on the boat, it would mainly in the beginning of the season. You know, you just open up the radio or anything electronic that was going to go on the boat, and just as long as it's not exposed, and it's like all the electronics are inside, I would just douse everything inside, including the speaker. You know, just really hit it pretty good on the inside, so it's almost dripping, and just close it back up, put the screws back in, douse it all over the screws when you're tightening up the screws. When you're putting your antenna connections, spray the WD-40 right on the antenna, the microphone connectors, put it in there, spray it on it. But the things that you'd probably want to spray more often, like maybe once every couple of weeks or something, would probably be the like the antenna connections and the microphone connections that are more external. But the internal, once a season, Dick.
From your experience, Glenn, are there things in a modern-day radio that WD-40 might give you grief? I can think, I'm looking at the push buttons on the front of my TS-711 that you're listening to right now. And behind those push buttons are probably membrane switches and things like that. Is there anything that WD-40 can get into a potentiometer, into a membrane switch, into a display, into the mechanical, mine's got a Dawson valve movement for the S-meter? Are there places where you've got to be careful not to put WD-40 because it might stop the normal operation? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Not that I'm aware of, Dick, except for meter movements. Meter movements are bad news. You don't want to use anything with a meter movement on a boat for a lot of reasons. The rot, the freezing up, whatever. LEDs or other displays are the way to go. WD-40, the only real downside to it is it's drippy and smelly. And let's face it, it's not a radio you're going to want to bring back in the house ever again. But as long as it's out of the boat, it's fine.